Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today. This is the first year that you might have noticed we did not serve lunch at this event, and I'm told that was a strategic decision to get people to go downstairs and spend money at Hudson Eats. So thank you all for doing that. Sorry we didn't give you lunch. It wasn't my decision, so sorry about that. We have a lot of exciting projects and opportunities advancing around the world within Brookfield Property Partners, and we're very happy for you all showing up today and giving us an opportunity to share with you some of the great things that we have going on. Before I get started, I just wanted to take a second to introduce a couple of my colleagues in the room with me today. In the front row here, Brian Kingston, who's the President and Chief Investment Officer of Brookfield Property Partners, Brian Davis, who's the Chief Financial Officer, John Seinbaugh. Many of you will have known him as Chief Financial Officer before Brian, now the Chief Operating Officer of our group, and Matt Cherry, who runs Investor Relations. So today we have 2 hours set aside for this session. I don't think we'll eat up all of that time, but we have prepared a formal presentation which Brian and I will take you through. And in general, we're going to give you an overview of Brookfield Property Partners at a high level, talk to you about some of the strategies and philosophies that that we employ. We'll take you through our core holdings in the office sector, as well as our platform, our development activities, our approach to development. We've got a lot going on in that area. We'll take you through our substantial investment in regional shopping malls and street retail, also our very profitable participation in opportunistic investments, as well as a financial overview and a discussion of what we see as Brookfield Property Partners' value proposition, which is probably the meat of our presentation today. So we'll have plenty of time for questions at the end. I'm told it's a little bit logistically awkward to take questions and get people microphones in the middle of the presentation. So if you wouldn't mind just holding questions until the end, that probably would work best. So, hopefully by the time that Brian and I are done with our presentations, you will be as excited about Brookfield Property Partners as we are. But, starting maybe with the end, in a slide that sums up what we hope that you will take away from today's session is Brookfield Property Partners is really a unique opportunity to own some of the most iconic and, frankly, irreplaceable assets around the world in the world's most dynamic and important markets, and to invest with one of the world's most experienced and successful real estate investors through a public security, which gives you all the transparency and liquidity that you would expect through such a vehicle. So for those new to the Brookfield Property Partners story, BPY is the primary investment vehicle for Brookfield's real estate investments. I say primary because it's not within our mandate to get involved in real estate services businesses, such as real estate brokerage businesses, advisory businesses, and that kind of thing. But by many measures and by most accounts, BPY is the largest commercial property company in the world. It's never really been our goal to be the largest, but rather to be a consistently solid performer, an investor, owner, and operator. Our focus every day has been on, bottom line, creating value for shareholders and minimizing risk along the way. We own many of the world's most iconic and irreplaceable assets across every sector, such as this office complex here, Brookfield Place in New York, or the Ala Moana Mall in Hawaii, or the Atlantis Hotel and Resort in the Bahamas. I'd be hard-pressed to find an industrial asset to add to that list, but if Jay Cornforth was here, I'm sure he'd come up with one. We also own three of the most valuable and highly regarded real estate franchises in the world, Brookfield Office Properties, Canary Wharf, and General Growth Properties, all great businesses that continue to drive value for Brookfield Property Partners. We are a full-service integrated owner, operator, developer, asset manager, possessing this kind of experience and knowledge going into an investment makes a really big difference. It cuts out the surprises, and it's really just another way that that Brookfield is a bit unique from others that, that do what we do. So, you know, just sort of taking you through our holdings for a second, we have investments in 138 premier office properties, just shy of 100 million square feet. Really, most of our holdings are in the world's gateway cities, such as New York City, London, Toronto, L.A., and Sydney. We also own 172 best-in-class regional shopping malls and some street retail assets, totaling 154 million square feet, mostly throughout the United States, with some incidental holdings in Brazil as well. We have high-quality assets with lots of operational upside. Most of these are more opportunistic investments in nature across the multifamily sectors, as well as industrial, hospitality, and triple net lease sectors as well. We also have a very active development pipeline. We'll get into a little more details on that in a couple of minutes. So learning from many years of experience and countless encounters with economic cycles, we've set up Brookfield Property Partners to be a diversified entity by property type, by geography, and also by type of investment. There are many times in a cycle where one sector might be out of favor, offering good opportunities while another may not, where investments might look better in one geography versus another one, or at times core plus investments are better than opportunistic. So with a large workforce and the way we've set ourselves up, we've got folks around the world feeding us real-time information about, you know, where are the best markets to deploy our capital, and we have a strategy that's set up around doing just that. So this slide here shows our current asset allocation on the left side by property type. We've got more information on that in a couple of slides, and on the right by geography. As you can see, the bulk of our holdings are in the world's most dynamic and developed markets of the U.S., Europe, Canada, and also Australia. So there are a couple of key metrics that I should point out about Brookfield Property Partners. The first is that 85% of our portfolio is made up of core quality office and retail properties. These fortress assets, located in steady, mature markets, give us a really solid foundation and stable current and future cash flow from which to grow. Through the full-service operating capabilities that we possess within our sector platforms, we're able to proactively work these assets and other core plus investments that we acquire to target total returns of 10 to 12%, showing growth and capital appreciation not typically seen in other core portfolios. To boost these returns further, part of our balance sheet, currently 15%, is focused a little further up the risk-return spectrum, targeting opportunistic investments and ground-up developments yielding 20% or better total returns. Again, using our platforms, which you'll hear us talk a lot about today, we're able to substantially lower the risk for these types of investments, basically lowering the volatility versus others that participate in the opportunistic investment space. So with a combination of these two investment strategies, we're targeting a combined total return for BPY of about 15% per annum. Our business, as many of you know, is global, and, you know, we, as I mentioned a moment ago, we have 14,000 people stationed around the world working out of 30 offices, but we're most active in the world's most developed and advanced markets of the U.S., Canada, Europe, and Australia. We also have a meaningful and long-term presence in Brazil, where we're seeing lots of opportunities today, and in the developing economies of China. And we're also invested in India, where they're the fourth largest office park developer. When, you know, it comes to our investment approach, we're very much value-oriented and often counter-cyclical in our investments, which underscores, I think, our investment approach. We specialize in looking after sort of complicated, multifaceted transactions where the field is narrowed and the returns are often considerably better. We leverage our operating platforms to enhance the value of our investments and as I said a few minutes ago, have the flexibility to move capital where there are capital voids around the world where we're able to get the best possible risk-adjusted returns. We're also very active recycling capital, which is a big theme for us, taking money out of mature assets and putting it into assets where we can use our platforms to create more value for our unit holders. So since Brookfield Property Partners was established about 30 months ago, we have been incredibly active, accomplishing a number of things. We've completed the $5 billion privatization of the 49% interest in our office business that we didn't own going into the creation of BPY. We also invested quite opportunistically an additional $1 billion into the ownership of General Growth Properties when some of our investors were looking for liquidity. After wedging our foot in the door about a decade ago and sticking with it, we're able to increase our ownership interest in Canary Wharf to 50%, gaining 7 million square feet of really high-quality office properties, some of the best in the world, and an 11 million square foot future development pipeline comprised of about half office space and half multifamily space. We also, on the heels of being exposed to the Bank of America acquisition of Merrill Lynch and a big gaping hole in the tenancy here at what was formerly the World Financial Center, now Brookfield Place, we're able to sign 3 million square feet of leases last year and bring this 8 million square foot project back up to 95% occupancy. We also, over the course of the last couple of years, have signed 4.4 million square feet of new leases with tenants to anchor some of our new developments around the world, and more about that in a little bit. So over the last 28 years or so, which is really sort of coincident with the tenure of the current senior leadership team here at Brookfield, we've invested about $33 billion of equity into various real estate transactions, generating in the process a cumulative track record of about 16% levered IRRs per annum. So notable large-scale transactions are shown on this slide on the screen. In 2005, 6, and 7, we were really focused on enhancing and expanding our office platform, acquiring the ONY properties and ONY REIT in Canada, TriZec properties here in the U.S., and also adding the multiplex group of office assets down in Australia. In 2010, it was really all about recapitalizing General Growth Properties, perhaps the best real estate transaction that we've ever done, and one of the best ever in the real estate space. In 2013, we used sort of a void in the market to create a logistics and industrial platform by making three acquisitions, and then, as I mentioned, in 2015, earlier this year, we were able to increase our stake in Canary Wharf. So in addition to these notable transactions, these are sort of the headline-grabbing ones, we've also been able to put to work another roughly $20 billion in a variety of transactions ranging from single asset properties to substantial portfolios. So that's sort of the high-level overview of BPY and how we're set up and sort of what we've been up to over the last little while. The next few slides get into the weeds a little bit more. Among our holdings is a world-class collection of some of the most prominent office buildings filling the skylines of some of the most dynamic markets and cities around the world. So I'll take you through a little bit of that. For example, we own the Darling Park complex in Sydney on the harbor, Canary Wharf, which I've mentioned, Brookfield Place here in New York on the Hudson River, as well as Brookfield Place in Toronto. In total, our core office portfolio is comprised of 138 office properties in gateway cities around the world. On average, the portfolio is 92.6% leased, with an average lease term of 9 years, so a very stable portfolio. Embedded in this portfolio are leases which are, on average, 20% below market rates, which provides a great opportunity for us. I'll talk to you more about that in a minute. And those of you who have followed us for a while know that we're pretty careful when it comes to financing our properties. We do it on a non-recourse asset level basis. So, you know, most knowledgeable real estate investors would consider the two best office markets in the world to be New York City and London. Reason being, properties in these markets maintain a high level of occupancy. They experience meaningful rental growth over time. Supply and demand and development approval constraints are in place. It's not really easy to build a building, so supply in general stays in check. And valuations move forward at a steady pace with modest cyclical interruptions. Within our holdings, 56% of our operating office assets are located in these two markets, and as well, 67% of our developments are in these markets as well. So in New York, we own interest in 11 operating assets totaling 20 million square feet. They are, on average, 93% leased. We also have a huge development on the west side in the Hudson Yards precinct called Manhattan West, 7 million square feet. And in London, we have investments in 28 operating assets totaling 11 million square feet, 96% leased, and 6 active development projects, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a couple of minutes. So as many of you probably know who have been following us, we also own a number of office buildings in the world's most established energy and commodity markets of Calgary, Houston, and Perth. And these are, as you can imagine, with commodities and energy prices, they're more volatile markets exposed to swings in basically commodities pricing. But there's a couple of important things to know about our investments in these markets. And the first is that we've really limited the amount of investment that we've made in such markets like this to 12% of our total office assets. So not really a major impact, but we also have many years of experience operating in these markets. And we've learned from the years that we've been active here that to basically be able to manage risk. So what do I mean by that? We put long-term leases in place, and we have high current occupancy. So in Calgary, for example, the average lease term of ours there is 11 years, 10 years in Perth, and 5 years in Houston. And our portfolios are pretty well leased in these markets as well. We've also learned from past experience on how to capitalize on this volatility. We often find ourselves in discussions with tenants that are in transition, giving us an opportunity to maybe take back space, flip it to another tenant, and pick up some additional proceeds and value in the process. And some of those discussions are going on today as well. So, you know, basically I'd say also with where energy prices, not that I want to spend a lot of time on this slide, but where with energy prices are today, although it doesn't help necessarily what's going on in these markets, it does really help the balance of our holdings, particularly our retail malls, which benefit consumer spending, and certainly benefits from lower energy pricing. So this slide here, it just sort of goes into how our core office portfolio has been performing. And I'd say, you know, we've been in the office business probably longer than any other sector of the real estate business. We've built over many years a very experienced team and have a major emphasis on leasing. Our 5-year average amount of leasing that we've done within this portfolio is just over 8 million square feet at 8.3 million square feet, or effectively 9 to 10% of our portfolio is leased every year. We're on that pace again for this year. And, you know, I'd point out because just if you take a look at this page, you know, because of the timing of a couple of lease rollovers coupled with some developments that have come online and the acquisition of some low occupancy buildings, our current occupancy is slightly below at the moment our 92.3% 5-year average, but we're working hard to get our average up actually above that to what has been our historical average of 95%. So I've mentioned a couple of times the importance of possessing full in-house operating capabilities. It's important when you're underwriting new investments. It's important for lowering risk after you've acquired assets. but it's also important to drive performance. Having global tenant relationships is also very important. We basically have a full-time group whose job is to do nothing but to nurture these tenant relationships and to connect the dots with our various offices around the world. So if a tenant needs space in Sydney, Australia, we've got a group that's in touch with them and finding the person in our organization who has the connection with the right people within that organization. As a result of all this, you know, a number of our tenants are repeat customers. In fact, 14 of our top 20 tenants are in multiple buildings. Nine of this group are actually in three or more buildings, and some of our tenants are actually in six or seven buildings. So, you know, I think when at the end of the day, real estate executives are spread very thin. They cover a lot of ground, and they want nothing but their life to be made easy for them. So you know, we make sure that we've established strong relationships with these folks. Just to give a real-life example of how that has paid off for us, in the fourth quarter of last year, we identified a building in the City of London that was a brand-new development just coming online, roughly 250,000 square feet, and it was only 7% leased. The developer in, you know, London office market right now has about a 2 or 3% vacancy. For some reason, the owner of this property decided to engage in discussions with a single tenant user. Those discussions died, you know, abruptly. The owner sort of panicked and wanted to sell the building. We rushed in and bought the building in a hurry, even though it was 93% vacant. And within just a quarter, we had the building 92% leased. And by the next quarter, so within 5 months or so, the building was 100% leased. So that building is Moore Place. And for us, you know, really what happened is we walked the building. We happened to know that one of our relationships was in the market looking for space. We made a phone call. They said they'd be interested. So we went into that investment knowing we could get the building leased up right away. So one of the benefits of our large platform. So this next slide here speaks to the strength of the income coming out of our office building portfolio. And 66% of our office NOI is derived from basically five of the world's top markets: New York City, London, Sydney, Washington, D.C., and Toronto. And the balance is effectively coming from other strong markets around the world. So very, very reliable cash flow coming out of our office division. In addition to solid income coming out of our office holdings, there's also plenty of upside. As I mentioned in prior slides, that, you know, we lease about 8 or 9 million square feet a year, as we intend to do this year. But in the process of doing that, we're able to basically capture the 20% discount to market rents that are in place within our portfolio. And this is you know, very important, I guess, as we move forward. I think Brian Davis, as he gives you the financial slides, will sort of put this into perspective for you as to what it means, but lots of upside coming out of our leasing as we do that every year. This slide just gives a little more detail on the in-place rents versus where the market is on expiring leases, and also shows you that roughly 20% of our leases, or our leases, are below market by roughly 20%. So in addition to capturing upside by closing this gap between market rents and in-place rents, we also similarly work to create upside through our redevelopment efforts and capabilities. We you know, often buy properties that, you know, well-located assets, but they have either leasing challenges, such as Moore Place, a substantially empty building, or properties that have capital needs. Maybe the prior owner lacked capital or the expertise to unlock value through repositioning and redevelopment. We leverage our design, construction, operations, leasing, and asset management teams basically to perform a thorough review of the properties and to come up with a repositioning and refurbishment plan. We also time our investments so that we can maximize our returns. So what I mean by that is we'll start a substantial renovation of a project like this when we know that Merrill Lynch is leaving the building, so that it'll be done roughly at the time the tenant leaves, as opposed to doing it 10 years before. You know, the bottom line is with this effort, we're able to charge higher rents and increase our return on investments. So just to take you through a real live example, we acquired a building in Manhattan called 450 West 33rd Street in 2011. The building's 1.6 million square feet. It's adjacent to our Manhattan West project, and it's quite possibly the ugliest building in Manhattan. This property, but it had just huge potential, 100,000 square foot floor plates, 16 foot floor to slab ceilings, which are roughly 4 feet better than a normal brand new office building. And it's really the kind of property that we knew would be attractive to media and technology tenants. So we've invested, or in the process of investing, about $312 million to upgrade this building by putting in a new glass facade, new lobby, replacing the HVAC system, and hopefully connecting the building ultimately to the High Line. As a result of all these things, we've recently executed about 400,000 square feet of leasing, and we're currently negotiating leases at about $80 a square foot. And I'll tell you more about that and why it's relevant in a minute. But the bottom line is we expect to create incremental NOI of about $56 million, or an 18% yield on cost, which is very substantial. So just a couple of pictures here to show you what we're doing. So this is a picture of the former ugliest building in Manhattan. It was, a Corvettes or some department store warehouse. So it had terrible windows. And in our redevelopment plan, you know, we really had a bit of a challenge. What we needed to do is, you know, number one, make it look good. Number two, make it desirable to users, which really meant taking out some of these concrete spandrels and creating a lot of additional glass. This created a bit of a conundrum for us because, you know, I don't know if any of you saw a Wall Street Journal article a little while ago deploring glass facades and arguing that we should go back to the days of punch windows and solid walls, basically to optimize energy efficiency, which in theory is all valid and fine. And the ugliest building in Manhattan certainly had those attributes, so we didn't really have to do much to achieve those things. But human beings crave daylight, and our team came up with, I think, a very creative solution to create both a visually intriguing facade that was also energy efficient. So. So here's a picture of what the building will look like when it's complete. And basically on the facade, what they came up with was a pleated geometry which improves energy performance and visual appearance and comfort as compared to a flat glass facade that just basically came down the sloping building's side. So this ended up being much more efficient. You can't see it here, but the upper glass pane of the pleat is partially opacified, which reduces the solar gain from high-angle sun. The lower pane, you know, therefore, is sort of self-shaded. And the bottom line is a energy-efficient building, actually more efficient than what was there before, but just provides great vision glass and views of the surrounding neighborhood. So, you know, a great job by our team. I'm sure you all agree, a brilliant strategy by our design team, and I know this is way too much in the woods, but the point is our platforms also drive value through our redevelopment, and this ugliest building in Manhattan, which we underwrote at $40 a foot rents, is now achieving $80 a foot rents, and on the top floors we're actually expecting to get $100 a foot rents. So it's been, you know, a great really turnaround story for us. Certainly the market has helped. We can't take all the credit for it, but I think our design positioned us well for this. So, you know, we've got lots of redevelopments going on. I won't go into as much detail as the others. There are a few slides here on Brookfield Place in a minute, so I'll skip over that. There's a building in Denver called 1801 California. similar to Moore Place. We bought the building knowing that it would be substantially vacant. There was a large user that was moving out of two-thirds of the building. We came up with a plan to invest $56 million to renovate it, new entrance, facade, lobby, restaurant, et cetera, have taken it from 37% occupancy up to 95%, and we project to earn returns of 20% levered IRRs and a 2.1 multiple of capital before it's all done. So, you know, I think by using our platform to, you know, increase occupancy, to capture mark-to-market rent increases, to reposition and redevelop our properties, we expect that our core office platform will show FFO growth of between 15 and 20% annually over the next 2 years. There's also $180 million of NOI that will come in over the next couple of years from signed leases. 75% of those leases are here at this project. So those are basically signed, not yet performing, but will all start to flow through the financial statements soon, and I'm sure Brian will have something to say about that in his presentation later. You know, the other thing is between our development and redevelopment initiatives, there's another $135 million of NOI coming in over the course of the next 7 or 8 years. So lots of upside coming just through our operating initiatives within our owned assets. So the last thing, I just spend a couple of minutes before I turn the podium over to Brian to talk about another area that we're working to create value for unit holders, and that's through our development. And, you know, over time, you know, we've assembled a great portfolio of land in high-value supply-constrained markets. We typically work to assemble sites, acquire land, take options on land during market downturns. We don't really like to participate in auctions when markets are at a high point or increasing. And we like to entitle our sites and be the first out of the gate with our development as the markets start to turn around. What we don't want to do is follow the herd and be stuck in a big glut of office space as markets turn around. So, you know, we opportunistically pursue our developments. You know, we're not just developing for the fun of it, but, you know, we do it at times where we expect office properties to trade through replacement value. We find it's actually, you know, more profitable to build buildings in those situations versus go out and buy buildings in an auction. So, you know, we don't consider ourselves speculative developers. We work hard to de-risk our developments. We typically like to have our projects 40 or 50% pre-let before we kick them off. We enter into guaranteed maximum price contracts with contractors to limit the construction risk exposure. And then we'll bring in joint venture partners once the project is substantially de-risked. And we limit our exposure to development, our capital invested in development, to about 10% or less is our goal. So just a minute on our approach to development, I'd say, you know, we have deeply ingrained in our philosophy this concept of placemaking. You know, what we find is that what employers really want is to rent space in a project that helps them attract and retain top talent. So, you know, from a lot of conversations with our tenants and from a lot of studying of the millennial generation, which is driving many businesses today, we've come up with our premium office brand concept called Brookfield Place, which really is a project that includes, you know, state-of-the-art technology, great floor plates, great ceiling heights, you know, great fenestration and facades, light and air, and amenities like retail that you see here, public spaces, animated public spaces with arts programs, near transit, and those kind of things. So, you know, we have a number of Brookfield Places. The first two were the renovated BCE Place in Toronto, now the renovated World Financial Center here in New York. And we're also doing ground-up Brookfield Places. We have one going up in Calgary, substantially pre-leased, so no need to worry about the energy exposure. And also one going on in Perth, Australia, and we're working on another one somewhere else in the world right now. So, So that's, you know, not, and although not every project that we do can qualify to be called a Brookfield place, that placemaking mentality and the research that we've done into what really is effective for a user goes into our developments that we do anywhere. So, you know, just a couple of pages on what we did here to this Brookfield place. You know, we, as I said, we spent a lot of time sort of studying that 30-something workforce group, which is driving today's business. What we find is that this group really wants a great work-life-play balance, and they want all three immediate to them and simultaneous, hence some of the things that we've done here with our public spaces at Brookfield Place. And I'll, you know, here's a picture of the connection to the transit at Brookfield Place. Here is a couple of slides here that show, you know, many of you ate at Hudson Eats, 14 sort of fast-prepared, high-quality food overlooking the Hudson River, Le District, a French market, and then lots of, you know, great retail shopping as well. So again, you know, very much influences our development design thinking and philosophy. So in total, we have $8.3 billion of developments underway at cost. They're all sort of prominent projects in high growth markets, most of which are London and New York, 42% pre-let on average, and we expect to produce $450 million of incremental NOI upon stabilization of these projects over the course of the next 7 or 8 years. And here's just a slide that breaks down the office portion of that development. 8.8 million square feet, 42% pre-let, $6.2 billion of costs, and the yield on cost expected is about 7%. We also have a number of multifamily developments going on. Those are basically in New York. And London, another $2 billion of projects in that area. So, in addition to the projects that are in the works and underway, we also have a development pipeline of another 19 million feet, and at the right time and under the right circumstances, we'll advance those as well, which will add even more to our future growth. So I'll just wrap up showing you a couple of slides on some of our development projects. Here's the Manhattan West project in New York. It's, you know, basically a mixed-use project, a couple of brand-new office towers in addition to the renovated one I told you about. There's a residential building as well, and also a hotel will be part of this project. But this is the first of the two million square foot office towers. It's been part of it has been pre-let to the law firm Skadden, and it'll come online in 2019. 100 Bishopsgate in London is a million square foot building in the city. We're negotiating final terms with a large anchor tenant who will take roughly a third of that building. And again, that's a 2019 delivery. London Wall Place in London is a building, is two buildings, 500,000 square feet in total, been substantially pre-leased to Schroders and the New York-based law firm Cleary Gottlieb. And that also will come online in two stages, 2017 and 19. And then Principal Place, London, it's a two-phased mixed-use project. One building is an office building, which has been substantially pre-leased, roughly 70% to Amazon. And then the second building is a condo building, which is about to go underway. And then at Canary Wharf, there's just a lot of great development going on. One Bank Street, partially pre-let to Societe Generale. We've got Brookfield Place East in Calgary. A million of the 1.4 million square feet has been leased to Synovus. The second tower of our Bay Adelaide Centre East project in Toronto. Anchor tenant is Deloitte. And the second tower at Brookfield Place Perth. Anchor tenant is, again, Deloitte, one of our repeat customers. So that's, sorry, a little bit in the weeds, but that's what we've been up to within our core office sector and a high-level overview of Brookfield Property Partners. I'll now turn the podium over to Brian to talk about our retail and opportunistic investments.
Thank you, Rick. So I am the first of, I think, at least three Bryans you'll hear from today. So very similar to our naming of our public affiliates, we try to keep it simple. So I'm going to start off talking a bit about our core retail platform, which, you know, very similar to our office platform, consists of trophy assets and irreplaceable locations in you know, the most dynamic markets around the world. The portfolio itself consists of 131 highly productive, best-in-class malls, enjoys above market average occupancy and tenant sales per square foot, and as most of you would know, we primarily own this through our 33% ownership interest in General Growth Properties. So you can see over the last couple of years, significant ramp up in tenant sales as we've seen a recovery in U.S. markets. You know, so stepping back and looking at some of the key trends that, you know, we're looking at and focusing on today within the retail sector, you know, the outlook for A malls and these high-quality fortress-like malls in the U.S. has never been better. Occupancy is very high. There is not a single enclosed mall under construction anywhere in the 50 states of in the U.S. And as the economy has rebounded, we've seen a pretty strong recovery in tenant sales, as you saw in some of the previous ones. And all of these factors combine together into a very strong rental growth outlook within the A mall sector. Certainly, the earlier part of this year, we saw a number of retailer bankruptcies. This was largely a shakeout within the industry of some of the weaker performers whose sales had been declining and weren't able to capture their margins. And they have been largely replaced by much stronger operators. And in particular, when you have A-mall locations where retailers want to locate their stores, it's much easier to replace those bankruptcies and, in fact, end up with a much stronger tenant profile. And so as a result of that, you're really seeing the A-malls outperforming the B and C-malls. You know, obviously, a topic of big conversation all the time is the impact of online sales on, you know, not only our traditional retailers but malls themselves and the format. And, you know, what we've found is by embracing this change and finding ways to leverage these new fulfillment processes that retailers are undertaking, utilizing digital media and really, you know, changing the type of customer experience that our customers have in our malls, can actually create opportunities for the malls through online sales. And maybe just to spend an extra minute on, you know, I guess e-commerce and its impact, you know, I guess just first a couple of facts to begin with. You know, 95% of all retail sales in the United States are done through from a retailer who has some form of physical presence. So while there is a lot of talk about sales online, the five largest online retailers, four of them are traditional retailers that you know, you would see in a store presence. And importantly, what we're starting to see is for those large retailers like Amazon or Bonobos or some others who have started out as exclusively online retailers, they're now making a move to start to create physical storefronts. It's important for them to have that direct interaction with customers. It helps with brand awareness amongst their customers and, you know, even simple things like returns, et cetera. So, you know, we think there's a real place for the malls. I think it's possible that the number of square feet of shopping centers that's required may be less than it has been in the past, but certainly for these fortress-like locations that continue to drive good traffic into them, you know, these are very desirable locations for retailers, whether they be online or traditional retailers, to locate in. You know, another big area where, you know, where I think that front-of-mind presence with customers is paramount in the minds of our retailers is with urban retail, and this is street front retail in you know, major metropolitan areas like New York, Chicago, Miami, and you know, similar to the A mall locations, these are critically important locations for a number of our tenants in terms of increasing their overall brand value, getting their name and their brand in front of the maximum number of customers. And so through GGP, Over the last couple of years, we've been starting to make an increased investment in this space, which has a lot of synergies and crossover with our A mall portfolio. And so in the last 3 years, we've acquired 9 assets, and at our share, this is at the BPY share, invested an incremental $370 million in this strategy. And very similar to our office portfolio and the mall portfolio, the strategy with each of these assets is to very actively asset manage them, invest incremental capital, re-tenant, reposition, fix these assets up, and make very large changes. And for these really well-located assets like this, you can have a very meaningful impact on the earnings of the assets and therefore the value. Acquisitions of new A malls is challenging at some points, just given where cap rates are today. And so to hit the kinds of returns that we're typically targeting, that becomes increasingly difficult. However, investing incremental capital in our existing portfolio can yield some very attractive returns relative to where these assets would trade for in the market today. I think on this page, I'm not going to run through all of the projects, but what this really highlights is there are numerous opportunities across our mall portfolio to invest very meaningful amounts of capital at unlevered cash returns that are 400 to 500 basis points in excess of where these assets would likely trade for in the market. And maybe just to put a finer point on that, I'll talk about one in particular that we're in the process of doing right now, which is at our Ala Moana Shopping Center in Honolulu. In 2012, we acquired the Sears box located next to our shopping center, and then following Sears closing down and relocating, actually demolished the box and created a new 600,000 square feet of inline space within the mall, repositioned the center hall, and then leased all of that space back up. So the total cost of the project, including the acquisition of the Sears box, was about $573 million. Post the renovation, it will generate an incremental $55 million of NOI for the shopping center. And so at a 4% cap rate, which is a pretty conservative number, and I say that because we just sold a third of this mall earlier in the year at a lower cap rate than that, in the low threes. But at a 4% cap rate, it increases the value of the mall by about $1.4 billion, or over $800 million in excess of what it cost us to do this project. So, as you see, with these types of assets that are very large scale, you can invest meaningful amounts of capital at very high rates of return and continue to reposition these assets for the future. So in summary, our GGP investment, as Rick mentioned earlier, has been one of the most successful investments that we have made to date. We've been in it for about 5 years. We've to date already earned about 2.5 times our money over that period of time. Since 2010, FFO and dividends have grown on average about 13% a year. But, we think the future is actually very bright for this investment. We think there's a lot of embedded upside left in this portfolio. A lot of the similar characteristics as we talked about with our office business, where there's contractual fixed rent step-ups in a number of our properties, as well as a significant mark-to-market opportunity as leases roll over and you begin to capture the benefits of that increased tenant sales that we've been seeing over the last couple of years. We listed a number of the repositioning or redevelopment opportunities that sit within the portfolio, and we think continuing to invest intelligently in urban retail and some other ancillary retail assets will continue to drive great growth out of this business as well. So, we're looking this business to be 4 to 5% EBITDA growth for the foreseeable future, which, when that falls through to the FFO line is pretty substantial. The fourth leg in our balance sheet, where we dedicate a significant amount of capital, I guess our core portfolio is really designed to generate pretty stable returns over long periods of time in very high-quality assets that we generally hold for much, much longer periods of time. But in addition to that, we do dedicate a portion of our balance sheet to these more opportunistic investments. And so, oftentimes we put them on pie charts and say it's office, it's retail, and it's opportunistic. This isn't actually meant to be a separate asset class, but rather a strategy for how we invest in certain assets. And oftentimes the form that this opportunistic investing takes is our participation in Brookfield-sponsored opportunity funds. And this is a great way for us to de-risk our investment in these types of opportunities by partnering alongside of some of the world's largest and most sophisticated investors, which allows us to do much bigger transactions and spread the risk around. It sounds pretty simple, targeting mispriced assets with upside potential and earning higher returns. How that actually gets put into practice really is a result of our, and Rick talked a lot about our 25-year investment history, but it's really bringing the best of all of that together to invest on a deep value basis, to leverage our platform to both source, identify, underwrite, and then ultimately manage these investments, and really drive value through operating the assets better, and then ultimately exit them over a period of time after having invested or invested incremental capital or driven leasing. We try to, in order to get these deep value opportunities, really invest in areas where we think we have a key competitive advantage. And when we look at our business today and our history, there's really a number of areas where we think that we have a pretty unique platform. Given the size and scale of our business, we have over $120 billion of real estate assets under management, $200 billion of real assets as an organization under management. So we benefit from significant scale. We benefit from being one of the only truly global asset managers, which means that we can allocate capital around to where we see the best opportunities. And it allows us to put together large amounts of capital to pursue very large transactions, where the competition is often much less. In addition to that, we tend to look at larger platforms, public to privates, restructurings, recapitalizations, and messier situations where we're not competing with what I would describe as sort of institutional investors who are really just looking for a generic exposure to real estate. It takes a real investment in a significant platform, and we have 15,000 people in our real estate platform alone to be able to execute on these kinds of transactions and deals like General Growth Properties, while they look easy looking back over 5 years, really brought together a lot of different parts of our business in addition to just the real estate underwriting expertise. And so that's where we often focus our efforts is these areas where we think the competition is thinner. This page really just sort of shows how all of that comes together in all of the businesses and all of the sectors and geographies where we are investing today. We have a significant presence already, a big platform with people on the ground, so that when we're inputting underwriting assumptions into our models, it's from people that actually work for us and have been operating and experienced in those markets. We're not relying on outside consultants or investment memos to come up with our assumptions. These are really inputs from the people who will be ultimately helping us operate and then disposing of the assets in the future. This page is probably a little hard to read from the back, but really it just shows that, really further breaking down the $33 billion of investments that Rick referred to earlier, in this more opportunistic track record, over the last 5 years, or sorry, last 25 years, we've invested about $16.5 billion in this strategy and have earned very high rates of return through all kinds of cycles. This includes the real estate crash in the early 90s, the tech wreck in the early 2000s, the financial crisis where we made some of our best investments. And over that period of time, we've been able to demonstrate a pretty consistent track record. In addition to, I think, the bottom line return, what I would draw your attention to is the consistency of the returns as well. And that really comes from this deep value buying with a lot of downside protection and, I'd say appropriate use of leverage within these investments, which is often where other opportunity funds got themselves into trouble through some of these cycles where we've had more success. In 2013, just to sort of highlight one of these fund strategies, in 2013, BPY committed $1.3 billion of equity to a Brookfield-sponsored fund called Brookfield Strategic Real Estate Partners. Alongside that $1.3 billion was about $3.1 billion of equity investments from institutional investors. This fund is now fully invested. It made investments in 24 separate assets. And so oftentimes you will hear announcements about transactions that Brookfield has done in the space. A number of them have been through this fund structure where we're effectively putting up about a third of the equity and the balance is coming from pre-organized institutional investors. At the moment, this fund is on track to generate north of 20% returns and double our money over its fund life. To look at the types of assets that are invested in the fund, they're very similar to the ones on our balance sheet. So again, as I said earlier, we're buying very high-quality assets. We're just trying to buy them in an opportunistic manner, manage them very actively, and then exit them over a reasonable period of time. More recently, we've committed a further $2 billion to Brookfield's next iteration of this fund. That fund is already active in the market and has made a number of recent acquisitions, many of which you know some of you may have heard about, including office buildings in London and in Brazil, multifamily apartment or a take private here in the United States, and a resorts operator in the UK. Very similar profile to the first fund. You know, we're expecting the returns on these investments to be well into the 20s and be north of a 2x multiple over a 5 to 7 year investment period. So to date, back to about 2012, just to talk about how we manage our balance sheet or how that translates into numbers, since 2012, we've acquired through this strategy about $17 billion of gross assets in this strategy, supported by about $7.5 billion of equity, of which BPY's commitment has been two. The other five came from institutional investors. So while $2 billion is not a small number for the size of portfolio and the diversity that comes with a very large opportunistic portfolio with exposure to multiple markets around the world, we think this is a very low-risk way for us to get great exposure and to these higher returning investments. So in summary, I guess our funding strategy for this opportunistic strategy is we generally try to be about 30% of the funds. As I mentioned, the funds have an average five-year investment horizon, targeting north of 20% returns. And as these funds begin to mature and the earlier vintages start to return capital, the whole strategy really becomes largely self-funding because as new funds are committed to, capital is being returned from our earlier funds to reinvest into that effectively. So with that, I will maybe turn it over to Brian, who's going to talk a bit more about how we have been managing the balance sheet as well as the value upside.
So thank you very much, Brian and Rick. And as Brian just mentioned, I'm going to take the next 20 or so minutes to talk about sort of two things that I think are pretty important to the story, and hopefully this summarizes what Rick and Brian has just walked us through. The first off is how we're going to position our balance sheet, how we have been positioning our balance sheet, and secondly, it's what the growth initiatives mean that we have underway mean to our earnings trajectory and ultimately the value of our underlying business. You know, to start off, positioning our balance sheet has been a major focus of ours for 2015, and I think that's for sort of three main reasons. First off, our number one objective was to repay the $1.2 billion facility that we raised to fund the cash portion of the acquisition of Brookfield office properties that took place in 2014. You know, secondly, we wanted to be able to generate the capital needed to fund the commitments that we have made, which Rick talked about with respect to our active development pipeline, and with what Brian had just talked about with our commitments to Brookfield-sponsored real estate funds. And lastly, we wanted to offer the flexibility to pursue other investment opportunities, including, you know, at the right time, the ability to repurchase our shares. So to raise capital, we've been focused primarily on one thing, and that's selling assets. I think it's the strength of certain of our markets. It's the strength of our assets that reside within those markets has provided us the ability to access the lowest cost of capital for us and also to be able to execute these asset sales in a very timely manner. You know, through the second quarter of this year, we had closed on about $715 million in asset sales at an average cap rate of 5%, which we've listed up here. On September 30th, we closed on the sale of one of our assets in Toronto at 70 York Street. And yesterday, we closed on the sale of an 80% interest in 99 Bishopsgate in London. Together, those two transactions are going to raise $350 million at a cap rate that's less than 5%. And we have another $1 billion of assets in the U.S. and in Australia that are currently in the market that we expect to execute in the fourth quarter or maybe through the first quarter, and we expect to be able to execute those at an average cap rate of less of in the mid 4%. You know, equally, I think, is appealing to us is the pursuit of the sale of interest in select development sites. And we did allude to this in our last conference call. And I, as Rick mentioned, our focus is to mitigate risk in pursuing, you know, development initiatives. And one of the ways we accomplish this, amongst, you know, many other things that Rick walked us through, is limiting our capital invested to about 10% of our total capital. We have done this successfully in the past by bringing in joint venture partners at our London Wall office development site and also at our Principal Place residential development site, both of which are in the City of London. But we are now pursuing, you know, three other such ventures, one of which we expect to close this month, and the other two in the first half of 2016. And, you know, upon successful execution, you know, we'll be able to raise $1.1 billion in capital at about a 6% stabilized yield, which, again, to us, you know, taking into consideration the risk profile associated with developments, is a very low cost of capital. You know, this cost-effective capital does position us with about $2.4 billion, and I'm just looking at the stuff that we plan to execute over the last half of the year and into the first quarter of 2016. And it's that $2.4 billion that is available to fulfill our commitments. You know, if I sort of listed them, which are on the slide, $600 million of those commitments are earmarked to fund the capital to build out the remainder of our active development pipeline. If you break that down into the next 3 years, it's about $200 million a year. $400 million of that represents our increased commitment to Brookfield's second real estate opportunity fund that Brian had alluded to. You know, part of the funding strategy that he also mentioned was, as the first fund realizes, we'll be in investing those proceeds into the second fund. Another $600 million is to pay off the remainder of the BPO acquisition facility that I just talked about. And the balance of about $800 million will be available to repay our corporate debt and credit facilities. So by executing this capital plan, I think we position our balance sheet with a minimal amount of corporate debt, which you can see up on this slide, but more importantly, it helps reduce our proportionate debt by a further 200 basis points, which supports our target of achieving a proportionate debt-to-capital ratio of less than 50% in the near term. In addition, it serves the purpose of rebalancing capital between our opportunistic platform and our core office platform, which, you know, with the acquisition of, you know, the BPO transaction in 2014, increased our exposure to office assets quite significantly. But I think more importantly, it illustrates how flexible BPY's balance sheet is. You know, it's $27 billion of assets on a deconsolidated basis. 45% of those are invested in office, 30% of those are invested in retail, 15% of those are invested in opportunistic strategies through the Brookfield-sponsored funds, and 10% are invested in development. This asset base is funded through only $4 billion of corporate credit facilities and other liabilities, and is supported by $23 billion of equity, which includes our units and also the mandatorily convertible preferred shares that we issued to fund the acquisition of Canary Wharf. And, you know, it does this, I think, more equally as important with minimal impact to earnings, which I illustrate on this slide. You know, you could probably just focus in the middle part of the table to get a sense, but effectively we're talking about a $5 million dilution to FFO through paying down $1.4 billion of, you know, relatively low interest rate debt. You know, how that gets made up, we have a reduction of about $60 million in income from the sale of $1.3 billion in stable core assets. We have a reduction of about $20 million in income from $500 million less invested in our development, you know, as a result of the joint ventures that we are pursuing. We offset this by allocating about another $400 million of capital into our, you know, opportunistic strategies, which we expect to raise us about $30 million. And we get the benefit of $45 million in lower interest expense from utilizing the remaining proceeds to repay our corporate credit facilities and an acquisition facility. So ultimately, it positions us really well, you know, for future growth. You know, as both Rick and Brian had talked about, you know, our goal is really to add value. We focus very much at adding value at the asset level. And in reflecting on what we've been able to achieve to date, which Rick did highlight in his opening remarks, you know, since our launch in April 2013, our IFRS value has increased, you know, almost 15% from $25.64 to $29.46, or at a compound annual rate of 7%. You know, in reflecting on the makeup of our $29.50 value per unit, and I think, again, you know, alluded to by both Rick and Brian, we consider it in the context of the net equity invested in really two distinct businesses. The first is our core platform. You know, our core platform consists of high-quality, well-located, mature cash flow-generating office and retail assets, which are much more REIT-like in profile. And this represents about $22 of our IFRS value per unit. The balance, you know, really represents the capital we have invested in the future growth of BPY, you know, through converting well-located land into office and residential towers, or in generating opportunistic returns through the capital that we have allocated to our fund strategies. And this represents $8 of our $29.50 value. You know, I think these platforms have very different earnings and risk profiles, and consequently they can be confusing when considered together, and in particular when considered as a multiple of earnings. Compounding that, and again, something that we alluded to earlier in the presentation, is that even our core operating platform is not generating a stabilized level of FFO. And at this stage, largely due to the expiry of the Bank of America Merrill Lynch lease here at Brookfield Place in 2013, but the expectations is it will shortly. So that takes us really to this slide, which makes one simple adjustment to our annualized earnings of $1.16 of company FFO per unit. And that adjustment is to reflect the impact of office leases that we have already signed but are not included in NOI. And when you reflect those leases, the story changes quite significantly. You know, these leases, which for the most part reflect the success we had in 2014 in signing leases on the majority of space that we had available in this complex, but also includes the balance of our portfolio in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and the U.K., you know, will contribute $180 million of net operating income to our earnings and will add about 21 cents to FFO, considering the cost of leasing capital over the next 2 years. You know, when you consider this, the multiple on our core platform drops from 25 times, which you saw on the other slide, to 20 times, which is more in line with our REIT peer metrics. You know, particularly considering the embedded growth that still remains in this platform as we stabilize the occupancy and mark-to-market the leases. You know, however, this does still leave the opportunistic platform as an outlier, you know, since its earnings profile really does not lend itself to being valued at a multiple consistent with a REIT. And I think in part we feel this may be one of the contributing factors to our current discount to net asset value that we trade at. And I think, candidly, it's what provides investors with such a great opportunity at our current share price of $22. You know, if you think about it, at $22, an investment in a BPY share provides you with an ownership interest, you know, in a core operating platform worth $22 per unit at a 20 times forward multiple, and an active development pipeline and an investment in Brookfield's successful real estate fund franchise worth $8 per unit, essentially for free. You know, in and of itself, you know, we feel that is a great investment, but when you combine that with the value potential that we see over the next 5 years, it makes that investment even better, which is a segue into sort of the next part of my presentation. You know, I think getting back to what I said earlier, our goal is to create value at the asset level. I think the foundations to achieve this goal, which include executed leases, the commencement of development and redevelopment projects, and commitments that we've already made to opportunistic strategies, they're already in place. I think for the most part, the next 5 years is all about execution. And the good news is our platforms have a 25-year history of doing that and doing it well. you know, I think fundamental to adding value to our business is increasing the income associated with our underlying assets. And BPY is positioned to see this increase in both sort of the short, medium, you know, and long term. You know, this increase amounts to about 7% compound annual growth of net operating income, which we expect to achieve over the next 5 years, and it aggregates just slightly over $1 billion. And I think it's really supported by sort of three things. One, which I talked about, leases that we have already signed. We are building out the tenant space, and we are just awaiting their occupancy to be able to begin recognizing that income. You know, it also includes the capital that we've invested in our opportunistic funds, namely from some of the recent acquisitions that Brian had just highlighted. And I think lastly, it includes the first wave of our developments and redevelopments, you know, led by Brookfield Place Retail in this complex, by our Brookfield Place complex in Perth, and by Bay Adelaide Center East in Toronto, which all come in line in 2016 and 2017. You know, in the medium to long-term growth, that's going to be further supported by completing the next wave of developments, you know, which include Manhattan West, both the residential and office development site, our development, our two towers at London Wall, and, of course, the building, the Brookfield Place that we're building out in Calgary as well. And in addition to that, we're going to continue to achieve same-store growth in our core office and retail platforms, you know, as both Rick and Brian had talked about in the context of capturing that mark-to-market. You know, this increase in income will, of course, drive an increase in FFO. You know, after considering the cost of capital required to achieve this and the increase in fees that we will pay on the values that have been created within our platform. And this will lead to future FFO of approximately $2 per share, or $2.60 when you consider the gains we expect to realize on the current capital that we have invested in our funds that may not otherwise get reflected in company FFO or FFO. And, of course, and as we've shown this sort of many times before, this increase in FFO will increase the value of our underlying assets, which we expect to increase to $46 per unit in the next five-plus years. You know, looking back to when we launched in April 2013, that represents an annual compound growth rate of 9%. And based on the $2.60 per share in FFO that I showed on the other slide, translates to an 18-times multiple of earnings. You know, I think increased earnings and value appreciation really support our goal of achieving a 12 to 15%, you know, return on capital in the long term. You know, in order to achieve these targets, we need experienced management teams, quality assets that earn top rents in each market. We need to maintain high occupancy, and we need to achieve same-store growth just as a base. The ability to recycle capital out of mature assets and reinvest that capital back into the business to support develop and redevelopment initiatives is additive to that base, and it allows us to generate the 10 to 12% returns that we hope to achieve out of our core office and core retail platforms. When you add on that the ability to participate through Brookfield-sponsored funds in the acquisition of a broad range of real estate asset classes in geographies all over the world, all of which target to earn 20-plus percent returns, that's where you get $22 billion of equity that has the earnings power of between $2.6 billion and $3.2 billion on an annual basis. And I think importantly, all of that is pretty unique to Brookfield Property Partners, and I think it's best supported by the structure of our business and the flexibility of our business model. So I guess to summarize, to pull this all together, I did want to end with sort of four thoughts. One is we continue to be focused on investor outreach and do very much appreciate everybody's attendance at our presentation here today. We do continue to work on increasing our analyst coverage, and we do want to thank Sheila McGrath at Evercore ISI and her team for picking up coverage on us just last week. She joins Mark Rothschild at Canaccord Genuity, Mario Saric at Scotia Capital, and Neil Downey at RBC, all of whom are here today. And hopefully in the next few months, we're going to continue to add to that list. And as you may have seen in our Q2 supplemental and these presentation materials, we are striving to improve our disclosure with the objective of finding the right balance between the information and analysis to be able to provide a concise picture of our business and potential, and we continue to welcome any feedback that we do get from investors and analysts. And I think most importantly, we are executing our business plan, which, as you hopefully got a sense of today, will surface a tremendous amount of value from our balance sheet over the next 5+ years and provide investors with an opportunity to earn very attractive returns through a combination of a strong and growing dividend and value appreciation. So with that, I might turn it back over to Rick.
So, Brian, do you want to come up as well? So with that, as our formal presentation, we're happy to respond to any questions that anybody in the audience might have. Michael.
Good afternoon. Rick, I was wondering if you can spend some time just talking about your investment in GGP. And maybe just there's a couple of cross currents going on. You've talked about how it's one of the most successful investments that you've had. Brian talked about the future being equally as bright. You're 5 years into it. There's a slide on your platforms on page 74. A lot of them have Brookfield Industrial, Brookfield Hotels, Brookfield Office, and then out sticks is GGP, which doesn't have the Brookfield or Brian subtext to it. Mall cap rates are pretty low. The institutional investor interest in the mall sector is very strong. GGP themselves is pursuing a buyback, which sort of lifts their stake. Where does that sort of leave you from your desire to either consolidate like you did in the office example or come to your useful life and decide it's the right time to exit to take advantage of the private market?
Okay, so maybe I'll start, and Brian, if you want to jump in, please do. So, you know, I'd say we're incredibly happy with the investment, as Brian had said, and also our association with this great retail platform. You know, also, as Brian said, we see a lot of upside left within the portfolio. I mean, based on the current business plan, we see a few years left of this great growth. So, you know, end of the day, would we like to own 100% of every platform that we're invested in? Sure. In an ideal world, that'd be great. But, you know, we're in the business of making money in the real estate business. And as long as this investment is performing, you know, we're agnostic as to how we're holding it and happy to continue to hold it. So, I don't know, Brian, anything you want to add to that? I mean, I think as long as we see upside remaining in the investment, we're happy to hang on to it.
You're on the board. You obviously have said it's okay for the company to buy back stock. Would you put incremental capital and also buy it with that discount, or you're sort of staying on the sidelines and letting your ownership creep up as they buy back stock?
Well, you know, as we've made a commitment to the company that we wouldn't exceed our investment, we wouldn't exceed 40% ownership in the company, and I think, you know, at the request of Sandeep, he's asked that we just sort of stay pat as far as our investment goes. In the meantime, we've got lots of other exciting things to put our money to work in, so it's probably in the best interest of GGP that, you know, we stay where we are and focus on the plenty of other things that we have to do. So.
Andrew Kusky, Credit Suisse. Could you just give us some perspective on the interplay of the capital recycling program and really the client base on the private fund side? Meaning, is it very easy to get certain deals done? Is you really tap one of the private fund clients to just monetize something on a direct basis?
With Brookfield's relationship with a lot of the world's best, biggest institutional clients, we've got a great audience to go to if we want to monetize assets. But typically what we do is we will run an auction. I'm not sure, Andrew, whether or not that answers your question. You know, certainly we're happy to see those investors participate in that auction, and we know well what they're looking to get involved in, which gives us a great head start in any process. So I'm not sure if that, you know, we do work closely with the private funds team to make sure we've got the best source of capital when we're trying to take money out of assets.
And then just a follow-up but related question. If we think about deal size, what kind of deal size do you think you could do if you tap some of the large clients for really direct?
I mean, Brian, why don't you?
I think how long is a piece of string? The business today has, we enjoy great access to capital. So I don't think that that's really a limiting factor. I think the transactions that we're looking at, and as I said earlier, we are sort of trying to focus on the larger end. So I think the thing that's really driving it is whether we can find the right returns, et cetera. But there hasn't, with a $7 billion opportunity fund, as well as a number of these investors who are seeking co-investment alongside of that fund, there really isn't. That's not the limiting factor when we're looking at deals.
Yeah, I think there are plenty of investors looking to put $50 to $100 million in a deal. There's a few relationships that we have that would put $1 billion into a deal, and in a few that would put $5 billion or more. So, I'm not sure there's a real estate investment out there that would be too big for us and our relationships.
Robert Zackhauser, I have a question about your Manhattan West development project. Could you give us a figure for the total projected cost? What percent Brookfield property itself is going to fund, and the other Brookfield entities, as well as the percent for entities outside of the Brookfield family, so to speak?
Okay, so the total project is is 7 million square feet, and total cost is roughly $4.5 billion at the moment. All of the equity is coming from Brookfield Property Partners. We've got how much debt would we have on it, Brian?
About 60% loan to cost. So if you take that off, we're looking at around $2 billion of. We're slightly less than $2 billion of capital that we're going to commit to that, all of which comes from BPY's balance sheet.
I would say, though, as we alluded to in some of our earlier slides, there's a point in the development cycle where we think about whether or not we've created sufficient value and what level of risk there is going forward and what is the right time to bring in an investment partner. At some point along the way, we likely will bring partners into this Manhattan West project, either to co-invest with us on individual components of the project or potentially the entire project.
And do you have any idea as to what the value might be when it's finished, a guesstimate do you want to give us?
Yeah, $7 billion.
So it's $4 billion for $7 billion?
Yeah, $4.5 billion.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Rick, one thing that you didn't speak about much this afternoon, that you spoke about last year, was the distribution growth, and you signaled a pretty high pace of distribution growth over the next few years, and you do have strong cash flow growth coming, but the payout ratio is relatively high. How do you think about the payout ratio and where you'd like it to be over the next few years?
So I would say our payout ratio target would be 90 to 100% of AFFO on a stabilized basis. We are slightly above that if you look at our current earnings, but as I had mentioned, in the short term to the medium term, the trajectory of our current earnings goes up quite significantly. I think we think a big component of the value proposition for our business is the ability to share a portion of our earnings as cash distributions to our shareholders, and similarly share a portion of that growth in earnings on a regular basis as an increase in those distributions. One of the things that makes, I think, looking at our business slightly different than if you're a REIT, is we do have flexibility within our balance sheet, which I think we hopefully illustrated a little bit in our presentation. AFFO and FFO only present one part of the story. The other part of the story is our ability to realize significant amounts of gains, particularly in our opportunistic strategies, which when you take those into consideration and you look at our payout ratio, it's probably in line to 50 to 60% of FFO on a normal basis. And we do consider that in the context of our ability to generate cash, to fund the strong dividend and expected to be growing dividend over the next 5 years.
Thanks. And maybe related, although this might be more for Brian Kingston, you said there's quite a bit of capital available to complete acquisitions, yet you laid out your asset sales plan, and much of that capital is already accounted for, whether in development or paying down debt. And also the unit price has been trading, it's at a discount to NAV, so obviously issuing equity is not ideal. You've actually been buying back stock. So are you somewhat limited in completing large acquisitions at this time, just with the capital that you need for other projects and without the, you know, the attraction of issuing equity?
I think the asset sales that Brian laid out really are the plan for, basically the next two quarters. So the fact is we have, a $60 billion asset base. We can continue harvesting capital from these lower returning, more mature assets and redeploying it into higher returning investments, which could be development projects, it could be future investments in our funds, or it could be buying back more stock. So long as that discount exists, where there's this large differential between where our share price is and what the underlying value of our real estate is, continuing to monetize and harvest capital at full IFRS value and buying back stock or investing in higher returning ones is a big part of our capital recycling story. It doesn't limit us in any way. That you shouldn't assume that those are the only assets that may be sold over the next 12 months. It's really what we're actively working on to fund the current program.
Hi, it's John Litt. Question on the topic of the discount. You outlined about $30 in NAV today, maybe $40 once you fully build out the portfolio. You're trading around 22. There's a variety of reasons why the stock may be here. I thought maybe you could talk about those. Obviously, BAM has a big interest in the company and probably an interest in seeing it trade closer to NAV. As you privatize Brookfield office, would it make sense and give you a better cost of capital at some point to have the public interest bought in by BAM?
Sure, yeah. I think our objective as the manager of the fund is to make this very successful. But, you're right, Brookfield has a $15 billion investment in BPY. We are highly motivated, as motivated as all of you, to see that be a success. So I think, as I said earlier, the option to continue to monetize assets at very high prices in the private markets and utilize that cash to either buy back stock or make these other investments is what we'll keep doing. I don't think we need to go as far as privatizing it. I think, and you guys would know better than I would how the market will ultimately appreciate this, but our view is our job or our role as the manager is to execute on the business plan that we've outlined here. And if we can grow earnings at 8 to 11% over the next 5 years and increase that NAV from $29 to $45, I think ultimately the market will appreciate that and we will get a proper discount. And if not, we'll keep buying back stock.
Thanks. How should one judge whether the fee paid to the external advisor is a fair one?
Look, I'm not exactly sure how to say that other than, there are a couple of different components to the fee. The base fee really approximates the overhead that the manager is taking on to look after this fund, and the rest of it, I guess, depends on performance. But
I think there's a very strong alignment, between the fee and the ultimate performance of the business, there is a lot of organization that's working behind it, but I think ultimately, comparing it to the cost of other operating platforms, et cetera, is maybe a good spot to start. I'm not sure how to answer as to whether it's fair or not, but we do think there's a very strong alignment there, and we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, and just to put that in perspective, BAM with $15 billion invested in Brookfield Property Partners and a return expectation of 10-12% a year, there's no amount of fees that will be generated from this that are more relevant than the return on equity expectations of BAM. Which is probably a good way to look at it.
I had two questions. One is just public to private. You talked a little bit about in the slide about opportunities. How willing are you to knock on doors to make those opportunities happen versus being invited into a process, in the case of AEC, and running through that? And behind that, where is the appetite of your capital partners, where that string is really long, where is their appetite globally right now for those public to privates?
We're not bashful about knocking on doors at all, but I would say we're not a hostile investor. You know, we're not necessarily going to show up and launch a hostile takeover of a public company. But you know, we have been both invited in to help recapitalize or privatize companies, as well as also knocked on doors and worked on transactions on one-off situations as well. So. But, you know, we don't view ourselves, if that's your question, Michael, we don't view ourselves as a hostile investor.
Do you see more public to privates occurring, given the discounts to NAV,
yeah,
especially in the U.S.?
Yeah, you know, Brian's probably better to answer this, but I certainly think there's more coming.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the disconnect that we talked about between our share price and the private markets isn't unique to our business. In fact, you know, the whole market is trading at a similar discount. I think, you know, within the public space, I think for the very high-quality portfolios, there's a huge demand from, to your question about capital. You know, we're seeing increasing demand for investments in the U.S. from, you know, Asian capital and other offshore markets coming into it. They're looking for high-quality assets, and they're certainly viewing the public markets as providing a better return potential than just buying direct assets in the private markets. So I think it's only a matter of time before you start to see those privatizations if the market continues to trade where it is.
And just lastly, the analogy of Brookfield Office, and I remember back to when that stock traded at a large discount to NAV and it was getting this complex for free, right? And what ultimately led a few months...
Which was true, by the way.
It turned out to be the case, but ultimately Brookfield bought everything in, right? So I guess what else can be done at the BPY level, you know, either strategically, you know, there's been a question about the external manager, you know, is there a time where you start thinking about structurally or strategically changing things to narrow that disconnect between the share price and the NAV?
Well, I think as has been said here, we've come up with a business plan. You've seen a big part of it in our presentation today, and you know, we're hoping executing on that business plan narrows that gap. You know, that's the goal. So I think it's way too early to be thinking about alternate structures.
Right. We've been in existence for 30 months, so we're still trying to get the story out there, and I think this is the forum where, you know, we're trying to portray to people the option that exists. You know, if they buy a share of BPY at $22, and really to separate our P&L and our balance sheet so that they have the right tools at their disposal to determine the appropriate value. And I think a large degree of that is clouded in the fact that we have so much upside growth and we have, you know, current earnings that aren't quite at its stabilized potential.
Yeah.
AJ Graywell, BCIMC. I just have a quick question on your slide 94. You talked about mark-to-market, you're getting 20% on your lease rates on mark-to-market. And typically my experience has been that many firms don't get that full uptick. So my question is, in those numbers that you have on mark-to-market, is that full 20% captured? And in the development and redevelopment, are you assuming the same market rate?
Well, I don't think we can get quite as specific with that. And this is really effectively meant to be illustrative. We've had a long history, both through our office platform and our retail platform, of achieving anywhere from 2.5% to 4.5% same-store growth. Achieving that same-store growth is a combination of, you know, occupancy and capturing mark-to-market rents. This is effectively what our earnings profile will look like. You know, if we were to estimate what market rents would go, you know, over the next 5 years and our ability to capture those market rents, it ultimately translates to about a 3% same-store growth, which is something that we feel pretty comfortable about being able to execute on in both of our core platforms.
You know, on a similar basis with respect to the development and redevelopment, those would be what the rents are that we underwrote. Ultimately, the decision to make the investment in the redevelopment or the development platform, and in a lot of cases, those underwritten rents, you know, are slightly below market. You know, in the case of you know, 5 Manhattan West, where we're looking to achieve $80 to $100 rents in the upper floors, you know, we wouldn't be reflecting necessarily $80 to $100 rents, you know, in the returns that, that we, you know, we will or we think we'll be able to execute when we lease out that space.
Brian or Rick, so question for, first just on the share price and kind of closing the gap to NAV. So it sounds like in the near term you guys feel like there's asset sales that fund the business, but I think as Brian Kingston pointed out, longer term, you've got a lot of scale. You could sell a lot of assets. So I think you'd like to narrow the price to NAV gap, but it doesn't sound like that's something that's necessary to kind of run and fund the business even in the medium term. So is am I thinking about that correctly, or are we missing something where you need to get your equity cost of capital competitive to think about the growth medium term?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we right now, as has been said, the most efficient source of capital for us is selling our properties at 4.5 caps, and we'll tap into that as long as it makes sense to do that. And hopefully in the process we narrow the gap, and you know, at some point our units will be trading at a point where we can tap into that source of capital if we need to. You know, we capital recycling is a big part of our plan. You know, our goal is to buy assets that we can put our platforms behind and create value and stabilize them and turn them into bond type yields and bring in institutional partners and take some money off the table and do it all over again. So I don't know if that answers your question. Well, Brian, you have something you want to add?
To add to it quickly, you're exactly right, you know, Brendan. What we tried to portray here is that we don't need to access the equity capital markets to fulfill this, you know, next 5 to 7 year growth trajectory.
And then just maybe as a follow-up to that, do you feel that we're several years into the recovery expansion, cap rates are really low, there's a little bit of concern about global growth that's out there. Do you feel like now is a good time to harvest, not just to kind of fund the growth initiatives that you have, but also maybe to take leverage down in anticipation that there could be better values a couple of years out, or do you not see a lot of risk that asset values are likely to retract sometime in the next couple of years?
You know, I think we always keep the fear in the back of our minds that asset values will retract at some point in the future, and I think you know, with the acquisition of BPO, we took on some short-term corporate-level debt to fund that acquisition, and what you're seeing now is us executing an asset sale plan to get rid of that leverage and really get our balance sheet down to, you know, where it is bulletproof. So, you know, as Brian said, once we get through all of this, we've got a $23 billion equity base with $4 billion of corporate debt. It provides us a lot of flexibility. You shouldn't interpret that to be a particular prediction on where we think the market's going. We think that's just the right way to run a real estate business in terms of, you know, managing your balance sheet, making sure you've got that flexibility so that when those downturns do come, then you're well positioned for that. And I think, you know, that's really where we're heading into 2016, regardless of whether the markets outperform or underperform.
Rick, in regards to the energy market, you made a comment how Brookfield has taken advantage of disruptions in markets in the past. Are you seeing any significant opportunities in energy markets, or maybe do you envision seeing any? One market that's clearly had some softness already is Calgary, so maybe ask that one in particular.
Yeah, I'd say of the three that we're in, Perth, Houston, and Calgary, Houston's a bit of a diversified market. It's not completely energy dependent, although energy is very significant in that market. But Calgary is pretty dependent on the energy sector, and we are, you know, we have had some preliminary discussions with tenants that believe that they're long in space. And, you know, they'd like us to sort of work with them on it. You know, the good news is the credits of those tenants are great. We don't need to do anything. But because of our relationships, you know, I think we're pretty skilled at sort of finding someone else to take space and working out a check and actually making money in the process. So I'd say that's the market where there might be more opportunities. again, we could do nothing, but in the past, in points like this in the cycle in energy markets, we have been very active kind of retrading space.
Good afternoon. Sheila McGrath from Evercore ISI. I have two questions. The first on buyback. You do have a modest buyback in place. If the discount to NAV persists, should we just assume you would re-up a buyback, or is there a limit how much you would want to buy back?
We would re-up it. Like the way our shares are trading, as we said at the beginning and all throughout the presentation, we're pretty excited about the future of BPY. Having said that, there's a lot of other opportunities as well. And before we make any investment, one of the things we'll look at is where our units are trading. So we'll keep doing it.
Okay. And secondly, there is a code structure that's coming next year, the GIC code for real estate. Just wondering if, to the best of your knowledge, will being a publicly traded partnership, will that preclude you from being included in that kind of classification, or have you looked into that at this point?
We've spent a little bit of time looking into it, and I guess as I understand it, it means taking real estate out of financials and creating two subcategories, one which is a REIT and the other which is a real estate services. I think based on our structure, we likely fall into the real estate services thing. I don't know if we necessarily know whether it's positive or negative. At the end of the day, I think it largely depends, on how indexes get structured around this new category and subcategories that exist within the classification structure. But, we are spending some time, trying to think through what implications it may have, hopefully positive.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Hey, how's it going? Stephen Gray. How will a rise in interest rates affect your business, given the floating rate debt at BPY?
Yeah, just to focus solely on the debt, if we do have a rise in interest rates, it would ultimately mean that our interest expense would go up. I do think we are very conscious about managing our floating rate exposure versus fixed rate exposure. We do put in place hedges that would sit outside of the debt that effectively, convert our floating rate exposure down to fixed rate. So we think we minimize it, or we at least control it within a level of risk that we're comfortable with. On the flip side, interest rate environments, changes in interest rates environment, of course, have an impact on asset values as well. What I think we like about our models is that we're invested in, four major, real estate asset classes. We're invested in, many, many cities, many, many countries, all of which react differently to a rising interest rate environment. And I think that gives us an advantage, at least a natural hedge over some of our more sort of focused, peers.
No further questions? Okay, well, thank you all for spending time with us. I think there is it a half hour until the next session? Who knows? We're going to stick around. I think there's refreshments out here. If you have any questions that you didn't get to that you want to ask any of us, we will all be out there. I think probably Brian and Bruce will be available as well. And if you have time, feel free to go downstairs to Hudson Eats, grab a cookie, spend some money, get a raincoat, something. Thank you for coming today.